Chapter 4. Carthage, circa 800 BCE to 146 BCE. During their reign as the apex predator of the Near East, the Assyrian Empire had long menaced the peoples of the Mediterranean coast. But one of those peoples would escape from under their thumb and forge an empire of their own, far over the sea. These were the series of city-states that more than 4,000 years ago rose up on the stony shore of what is today Lebanon, overlooked by towering mountains covered in cedar forests. The largest of these cities were Tyre, Sidon, and Byblos, and they were the birthplace of a culture that would one day be called Phoenician. The Phoenicians were given the name Phoenike by the Greeks, but it's unlikely that they would have used that word about themselves. They were united by a common Phoenician language and by worship of gods such as Baal Hamon, a heroic god named Melkart, and his wife Astarte, but there's little to suggest a common identity, architecture, or literature. Even the Greek word Phoenician has a somewhat mysterious origin. In early literary works such as the Iliad and Odyssey, phoenix is also used to describe a particular shade of purple or crimson, and also a date palm, possibly due to the reddish color of its ripe fruit. And so it has been suggested that the name comes from one of their earliest and most successful industries. The Phoenicians of Tyre and other cities were among the first people to color their clothes with a particular dye derived from the bodies of predatory sea snails known as the murex or rock snail. These snails produce their dye as a defense mechanism against predators, and depending on the species, can produce a vivid red or purple color, unlike anything else available in the ancient world. It could take more than 50 kilograms of snails to make a single gram of this dye, and as a result, these fabrics were extremely expensive. In the ancient world, the color purple soon became associated with wealth, and in turn, with royalty. This color became known as Tyrian purple after the city of Tyre, and later imperial purple, and it dyed the robes of the emperors of Assyria, Rome, and later Byzantium. So it's possible that Phoenike came to be used to describe these traders from the rocky coast of Lebanon as the purple people. With the dye industry booming, the Phoenicians ventured out on ever longer voyages out into the Mediterranean, driven by the need to procure more of these priceless snails. Since as early as the 3rd millennium BCE, Phoenician sailors from Byblos had developed ships with curved hulls, perfectly suited for traveling on the waves, along with techniques for waterproofing the hulls using bitumen or pitch. In the book of Ezekiel in the Hebrew Bible, we find a poetic description of such a ship. They have made all thy shipboards of fir trees of Senir. They have taken cedars from Lebanon to make masts for thee. Of the oaks of Bashan have they made thine oars. The company of the Ashurites have made thy benches of ivory, brought out of the isles of Chittim. Fine linen with broidered work from Egypt was that which thou spreadest forth to be thy sail. Blue and purple from the isles of Elisha was that which covered thee. The Phoenicians cultivated a reputation as able seafarers and as uncompromising and shrewd traders, which earned them some degree of unpopularity. The Odyssey, written down in the 8th century, describes the Phoenicians as cunning and untrustworthy, the antithesis of the supposedly noble Greeks. Thither came Phoenicians, men famed for their ships, greedy knaves, bringing countless trinkets in their black ship. The Mediterranean Sea, on which the Phoenicians flourished, had long been an insurmountable challenge to many of the region's powers. The Assyrians referred to it as Idmarati, or the Bitter River, which they believed to surround the whole earth, while the Egyptians referred to it as Wajwer, or the Great Green. These empires were river cultures and were wary of the sea. For this reason, they were heavily reliant on commodities brought into the region by Phoenician sailors. Assyria thus offered the cities of Tyre and Sidon a degree of independence, so long as they ensured a constant supply of copper, tin, silver, and other resources into Assyria, and acted as a navy for hire, providing their ships and sailors to the empire in times of war. Knowing what fate befell those who opposed Assyria, the Phoenicians had little choice but to accept. But Assyrian demand for metal was truly staggering, and meeting it would require a drastic expansion of the Phoenician trade network. As a result, the Phoenicians would buy their independence and get rich at the same time. At first, the Phoenicians set up simple trading posts at locations where they could find the most metal, such as Cyprus, with its stores of copper, and Sardinia, the Mediterranean's second largest island, rich in copper, iron, silver, and lead. Phoenician settlers began arriving here in the middle of the 9th century BCE and set up partnerships with the local people. These locals did the actual mining, while the Phoenicians simply turned up to buy the goods and take them away by ship. From Cyprus and Sardinia, Phoenician sailors pushed further west and set up the small colony of Utica in North Africa, and even reached southern Spain, where the mines practically overflowed with silver, iron, and other metals. Archaeologists have found huge Phoenician furnaces in this region, designed for smelting metal ingots for transportation on an industrial scale. Before long, the Phoenicians were sailing through the Straits of Gibraltar, then known as the Pillars of Hercules, and out into the Atlantic Ocean, more than 4,000 kilometers from their homeland. The earliest piece of Phoenician writing found outside the Levant is an inscribed tablet known as the Nora Stone, unearthed in Sardinia, and apparently commemorating a Phoenician leader who may have died in conflict with the local people there. "He fought with the Sardinians at Tarshish and drove them out," it reads. "Among the Sardinians he is now at peace, and his army is at peace. Milcaton, son of Shubna, general of King Pumei." But for the most part, the Phoenicians seem to have interacted with the people they met relatively peacefully, and most of all, profitably. And before long, Tyre, Sidon, and Byblos found themselves at the far east of a trade network that sprawled ever westwards over the Mediterranean. Soon the center of the Phoenicians' power would also shift in that direction, to a place where they could finally be free of the overbearing empires that constantly breathed down their necks. They would found a city there that would become one of the largest and wealthiest on earth. That city would one day be known as Carthage. Like so many aspects of our modern understanding of the Phoenicians, the name Carthage is itself a distortion, filtered through the accounts of others. In Latin, the city was known as Carthago, while the Greeks called it Carchedon. But to its inhabitants, it was known as Carthadasht, meaning the new city. Like many cities of its time, Carthage soon developed its own founding myth. It begins with a princess of Tyre named Elissa, or Elishaya, who flees Tyre with a number of servants and temple women when her treacherous brother Pygmalion moves to seize her throne. This group of refugees sails along the coast of North Africa and comes ashore near the Phoenician colony of Utica, setting up camp on a hill known as Byrsa. The king who rules there, Iarbas, takes pity on them, but not too much pity. He offers to sell them a plot on the hill no bigger than an ox hide. But Elishiah is cunning and cuts the hide into thin strips, lining them up to enclose the entire hill, a much larger area than the miserly king had intended. Iarbas has no choice but to give them the land he promised. And so Carthage is born. From the hilltop of Byrsa, the city grows and grows, soon eclipsing King Iarbas's town of Utica. The miserly king becomes jealous and demands that Elishiah marry him so that he can absorb her flourishing town and everything she owns into his kingdom. If she refuses, he will burn the new city to the ground. Faced with this choice, Elishiah builds a pyre and climbs onto it, killing herself. This tragic but noble sacrifice has proven irresistible to generations of poets, and the Roman poet Virgil gives one rendition. Fluttered and fierce in her awful purpose, with bloodshot, restless gaze and spots on her quivering cheeks burning through the pallor of imminent death, she mounts in madness the high funeral pyre and unsheaths the sword of Dardania. She sank on the pillow and spoke the last words of all. Receive my spirit now and release me from my distresses. I have lived and fulfilled fortune's allotted course, and now I shall go, a queenly phantom under the earth. In honor of Elishiah's sacrifice, her people gave her the title of Dido, meaning female warrior or heroine, and this was the name by which she would later be known to Roman writers. This Baroque tale of honor and tragedy has all the hallmarks of classical literature, and we can't assume that it bears any relationship to real events. Some details accord with what archaeology tells us. The city was founded close to the older settlement of Utica, which it soon eclipsed in size. But perhaps the most important part of this founding myth is the hint it may give us about how the Carthaginians thought of themselves and their place in the world. As a city of survivors who had found a refuge here on the North African coast, a city of sailors, they were resourceful and drove a hard bargain. They were clever, fond of outwitting their enemies, and they could always make a little go a long way, and perhaps that they would die before they gave up their freedom. Regardless of its origins, it's clear from archaeology that the new colony city of Carthage grew quickly. This was partly thanks to its geography, which made it in many ways the perfect Phoenician settlement. Carthage was built in a small bay that itself belonged to a vast natural harbour, known today as the Gulf of Tunis. It stood on top of a series of sheer red cliffs that looked down over the glittering blue waters of the Mediterranean, and it was also easily defended on its landward side, where a range of rocky hills, interspersed with lakes and saltwater lagoons, break the land into a series of narrow approaches. Standing at the crucial halfway point between Tyre and the wealthy mines of Spain, it was also only about 200 kilometers by boat from Sicily and about 300 kilometers from Sardinia, two crucial sites of Phoenician industry that were only growing in importance. Pottery found in even the earliest layers of Carthage's settlement shows a huge range of styles, coming from Greece, Italy, Spain, and all the Phoenician colonies. Carthage also assimilated the existing population of North African peoples and formed a hybrid culture that was part Phoenician and part African. This early archaeology paints a picture of a humble collection of mud brick buildings lining the seashore, but within a century, this outpost had exploded into a much more sophisticated and complex cityscape. From the Greek writers, we learn that Carthage was a republic. It was ruled under a kind of oligarchic system, governed by a council of its wealthiest citizens. Aristotle, in his 4th century BCE work, Politica, or Politics, writes approvingly of the Carthaginian system of government and compares it to that of the Greek city-state of Sparta. Many regulations in Carthage are good, and a proof of a well-regulated constitution is that the populace willingly remained faithful to the constitutional system, and that neither civil strife has arisen in any degree worth mentioning, nor yet a tyrant. But he also warns that the Carthaginian system put too much emphasis on the wealth of its rulers rather than their competence, and expresses concerns that this could lead to corruption. They think that the rulers should be chosen not only for their merit but also for their wealth, as it is not possible for a poor man to govern well or to have leisure for his duties. It is a bad thing that the greatest offices of state, the kingship and the generalship, should be up for sale. For this law makes wealth more honored than worth, and renders the whole state avaricious. And it is probable that those who purchase their office will learn by degrees to make a profit out of it. Certain powerful families vied constantly for position, but there was no hereditary royalty in Carthage, and it's possible that here the myth of Elishaia or Dido played a role. Since the city was supposedly founded by a woman who had no children, no one could ever claim to be her true descendant or to have an ancestral right to rule. Instead, the city was governed by a number of different semi-democratic bodies made up of wealthy citizens. One of these was called the Tribunal of the 104, and another the Council of Elders, a kind of senate. The highest executive position was held simultaneously by two annually elected officers, who ruled on all civilian matters. The arrangement was complex and likely prone to corruption, but for the most part, it seems to have worked. While Carthage flourished, the Phoenician cities that had given birth to it began to flounder. Tyre and Sidon were still under the boot of Assyria, and around 670 BCE, the Assyrian king Esarhaddon forced them to embargo his enemies in Egypt, cutting off their most lucrative market. Soon, the surviving treaties show us that the king of Tyre was not even allowed to open messages without an Assyrian official present. As a result of these restrictions and the economic decline that followed them, it's likely that large numbers of Phoenicians fled to what was now the undisputed capital of the Phoenician world, the booming port city of Carthage. They brought their language, their knowledge, their gods, and their gold with them. By the 6th century BCE, Carthage was one of the largest and wealthiest cities in the Mediterranean, and its sailors would soon embark on voyages of exploration that would not be matched for another 2,000 years. The Phoenicians by this time had already sailed right to the end of the known world, through the Pillars of Hercules and out into the Atlantic Ocean. But their exploration didn't stop there. In fact, if ancient sources are to be believed, they may have been the first navigators to successfully circumnavigate Africa. Herodotus recounts one expedition that purportedly took place around 600 BCE, sponsored by a pharaoh of Egypt named Nekos. So the Phoenicians set out from the Red Sea and sailed the Southern Sea. Whenever autumn came, they would put in and plant the land in whatever part of Libya they had reached, and there await the harvest. Then, having gathered the crop, they sailed on, so that after 2 years had passed, it was in the third that they rounded the Pillars of Hercules and came to Egypt. There they said, what some may believe, though I do not, that in sailing around Libya, they had the sun on their right hand. Ironically, it is this detail that Herodotus finds unbelievable that has caused modern scholars to take the claim more seriously. The change in the position of the sun relative to the ship suggests that the voyage did indeed cross the Tropic of Cancer, and perhaps even the equator, causing the summer sun to appear in the north. If this story is true, then it means the Phoenicians may have rounded the southern tip of Africa more than 2,000 years before the Portuguese explorer Bartolomeu Dias in 1488. More solidly attested voyages of Phoenician discovery would see an explorer named Hanno the Navigator sail perhaps as far south as Cameroon or Gabon. His voyage is recounted in a Greek text entitled The Periplus of Hanno, supposedly an accurate copy of an inscription that hung in the temple of Baal Hamon in Carthage. Hanno gives a vivid description of rivers of lava flowing into the ocean, possibly referring to the active volcano Mount Cameroon. We saw the land at night covered with flames, and in the midst there was one lofty fire greater than the rest, which seemed to touch the stars. Hanno even writes about encountering gorillas, one of whose skins he took back with him to Carthage, where it was hung in a temple. Another explorer named Himilco went in the opposite direction, sailing out into the Atlantic and north up the coast of Spain and France, and as far as the British Isles. There he saw whales in the Atlantic, and Celtic tribespeople sailing in coracles made of deerskin, a sight he found remarkable. "They cleave the tempestuous sea and the current of the ocean abounding in monsters with woven boats, from hides stitched together, and often travel through the immense sea in a skin." In 2019, a team of 20 modern sailors successfully piloted a replica of a single-masted Carthaginian merchant vessel across the Atlantic, departing from Carthage and landing in the Caribbean 5 months later, demonstrating that Phoenician ships had the ability to reach the Americas 2,000 years before Columbus. As the population of Carthage grew, the city expanded. By 400 BCE, it may have reached a population of 400,000, and its walls had been rebuilt to a towering 15 meters high, with a triple line of ditches and defenses on the landward side. The hill of Birsa was now ringed not with an ox hide, but with an imposing inner wall, looming over the rest of the city as a fortified citadel. Between there and the harbour stood the agora, the large open marketplace where all manner of goods and foods could be bought. Archaeological studies of plant matter found in Carthage show that its citizens enjoyed a varied diet: wheat, barley and other grains, artichokes and cabbages, pulses and lentils, and fruits and nuts including pomegranates, grapes, figs, olives, peaches, plums, pistachios, and almonds. They ate olive oil, plenty of fish such as grey mullet, sea perch, and eels, and dolphins, as well as the meat of sheep, goats, pigs, chickens, and occasionally dogs. The Carthaginians, like most people in the ancient world, were also obsessed with a pungent, salty sauce known as garum, which was brewed from fermented fish entrails, and was probably similar to the fish sauce used in East Asian cuisine today. In the wreck of one Carthaginian ship, archaeologists have uncovered the remains of cannabis stalks, which may also have been enjoyed on land, possibly brewed into a tea. Wine was particularly beloved too, and especially a kind of sweet dessert wine made from sun-dried grapes. A variety of animals would have been visible on the crowded city streets, including beasts of burden like oxen and horses, stray dogs and cats, and noisy caravans of donkeys arriving from the desert, the camel having not yet been introduced. A species of monkey known as the Barbary macaque is also native to this area, and Diodorus of Sicily records that Carthaginians kept these monkeys as apparently much-loved pets. In these cities, many of the customs were very different from those current among us, for the apes lived in the same houses as the men, being regarded among them as gods, just as the dogs are among the Egyptians. And from the provisions laid up in the storerooms, the beasts took their food without hindrance, whenever they wished. And of course, in cavernous stables to the south of the city, were kept the animals that in many people's minds are most inseparably associated with Carthage, the elephants. The North African elephant is an extinct subspecies that lived north of the Sahara Desert. Carthaginian frescoes, coins, and mosaics show that these animals had the swooping backs and large ears typical of the African elephants that roam the savannah. But they were considerably smaller, perhaps similar in size to another surviving subspecies, the African forest elephant. These reach a shoulder height of about 2.5 meters, though their heavy frames mean they weigh more than 15 times the average horse. For this reason, these elephants were used by the Carthaginians as fearsome weapons of war. In India and Southeast Asia, it has always been common to use elephants as beasts of burden, to transport heavy loads for construction, but it's not clear whether the Carthaginians used their elephants in this manner, or whether these precious animals were only reserved for their power and prestige, to be used as living tanks on the battlefield, as the Roman historian Pliny the Elder describes. Elephants, when tamed, are employed in war and carry into the ranks of the enemy towers filled with armed men. And on them, in a very great measure, depends the ultimate result of the battles. They tread underfoot whole companies and crush the men in their armor. As in India, these elephants may also have been used ceremonially in festivals and parades to carry kings and generals, as a living embodiment of the might of this new empire. While Carthage didn't hesitate to go to war to defend its interests and protect its trade, it preferred diplomatic solutions to avoid fighting with its various Mediterranean neighbors. One such agreement was settled in 509 BCE with a minor city-state in central Italy, in the region of Latium, whose people spoke a small Italic dialect called Latin. These people had just that year thrown off the rule of their Etruscan king and brought in the rule of a pair of elected consuls drawn from the aristocracy, a system strikingly similar to, and perhaps even inspired by, the Carthaginian one. The name of this city was Rome. The Romans at that time were one among several powers in central Italy, facing rivals in the Etruscan kingdom, and powerful tribal confederacies like the Samnites, who were all fighting for dominance in central Italy. The Carthaginians seem to have taken note of this regional development and proceeded to sign a treaty with the new Roman Republic, the contents of which the Greek historian Polybius recalls. There shall be friendship between the Romans and their allies, and the Carthaginians and their allies, on these conditions. Neither the Romans nor their allies are to sail beyond the fair peninsula, unless driven by stress of weather or the fear of enemies. Carthage shall build no fort in Latium, and if they enter the district in arms, they shall not stay a night therein. The theme of the treaty was simple. You leave us alone, and we will leave you alone. And while Rome had clearly got their attention, it seems Carthage considered this new Italian republic to present little cause for concern. Around 410 BCE, Carthage began minting its own silver coins, each stamped with the symbol of a palm tree, apparently a pun on the Greek word phoenike. By promoting this symbol of Phoenician identity, Carthage was putting itself forward as the champion of the Phoenician people, the capital of the Phoenician world. Carthage now looked a lot like an empire, and like all empires, it soon found an increasing need to go to war. It's often said that Carthage relied on mercenaries to fight its wars, but in fact most of their soldiers were conscripted under the terms of treaties. Neighboring Numidia to the west sent experienced cavalry and javelin throwers, while colonies on the island of Majorca sent slingers, and peasant spearmen with large round shields came from the fields of Libya. Celts from Spain made up some part of their forces, and sometimes even Greeks and Italians ended up fighting in these armies. There was only one group of people who hardly ever fought for Carthage, and that was the citizens of Carthage themselves. The Carthaginian system relied largely on making life as comfortable as possible for the people of the capital. While its lower classes were sometimes drafted into the navy, few Carthaginian politicians ever risked the unpopular move of conscripting citizens to fight in the army. This was considered a job for other peoples. But soon, Carthage would find itself embroiled in a bitter struggle that would test this system to breaking point and threaten to bring the whole empire to the brink. These wars erupted over what was soon to become the most fought-over piece of land in the Mediterranean, Sicily. Sicily is the largest island in the Mediterranean Sea, its landscape dominated by the active volcano Mount Etna, and separated from Italy by the narrow straits of Messina. At first, Carthage enjoyed an unrivaled position on the island, trading with the locals in the west, a short hop away from their capital in North Africa. But soon they came into conflict with another group of people that for much of this history were their greatest rivals on the sea and on land, a people who were also busy establishing colonies across the Mediterranean. These were the Greeks. The Greeks, like the Phoenicians, were expert sailors and had built a number of thriving colonies in southern Italy, in what is now Turkey and around the Black Sea. From the 8th century BCE, Greek explorers and traders began expanding their interests into southern Italy and Sicily, an area that they would come to call Megale Hellas, or Greater Greece. Greek settlers were in part inspired by the myth of their hero Heracles, whom the Romans would call Hercules. In some Greek colonies, this half-divine warrior was celebrated for slaying giants and mythical beasts, while in others his feats were more mundane. In southern Italy, for instance, he was remembered for banishing a plague of flies. In one of the most dramatic episodes, during his 10th labor, Hercules is tasked with stealing the red cattle belonging to the ogre Geryon, who lived in Erythea in southern Spain. Since Geryon lived so far in the west, it was said, the hides of his cattle had been stained red by their proximity to the setting sun. After killing Geryon, Hercules takes his cattle and herds them all the way back home. Heracles then made his way from Celtica to Italy, Diodorus of Sicily writes. And as he traversed the mountain pass through the Alps, he made a highway out of the route, which was rough and almost impassable. This story of Hercules crossing the Alps was the dramatic pinnacle of a series of myths that would become known as the Heraclean Way, which were told to countless generations of Greek settlers, and then to the children of the Romans who followed them. As the Phoenician god Melkart became increasingly associated with Hercules, these stories were also told to the children of Carthage. For several centuries, the Greek settlers in eastern Sicily maintained an uneasy peace with the Carthaginian settlements in the west. But as both powers required greater amounts of land to support their colonies, they found themselves on a collision course. By the late 5th century BCE, Sicily had erupted in warfare. For the citizens of Carthage, exempt as they were from serving in the army, the fighting must have seemed a long way from home. And they were content to let these wars simmer on for years. But the final episode of these conflicts, known as the Seventh Sicilian War, was to puncture this sense of invulnerability and bring the war home to their shores in dramatic fashion. Their rival in this story was a king of Syracuse, a Greek city-state on the southeastern coast of Sicily, and his name was Agathocles. Agathocles began life as a commoner in the Sicilian colonies, but entered the army and rose through its ranks until he was able to enact a military coup and seize the throne of Syracuse in 317 BCE. From there, he set about subjugating cities all around him, and it wasn't long before the Carthaginians saw Agathocles as a serious threat. Carthage amassed a huge army, sailed for Sicily, and beat Agathocles back to Syracuse, where they laid siege. With his city surrounded and no hope of reinforcements, Agathocles must have been desperate. But in a flash of inspiration, he decided on a truly daring course of action. He hatched a plan to break free of the siege by ship, set sail for Africa, and make a strike at the heart of his enemy, the city of Carthage itself. When the Greek fleet set sail, the Carthaginians believed Agathocles to be fleeing. They chased him across the sea, pelting him with arrows, but he and his men were able to cross the sea and land on the beaches of Africa. Famously, he ordered his ships to be burned, to ensure that his men would have nowhere to run, and no choice but to fight. From the city walls of Carthage, the fires of the burning ships would have been visible on the horizon, and fear spread among its citizens. Carthage amassed a hurried army of citizen soldiers, hoping to overwhelm Agathocles with sheer numbers. But when they met the now desperate Greeks in battle, the inexperienced Carthaginians were sorely beaten and fled back to the city. The result was pandemonium. The city had never been significantly threatened before, and there were now virtually no forces there to defend it. So great was the panic, as Agathocles bore down on them, that the Carthaginians seemed to have turned in their desperation to an ancient rite that represents one of the darkest and most controversial aspects of their history, the ritual of child sacrifice. These were violent times when human life was cheap. But even so, this practice was mentioned with some revulsion by several ancient writers. The practice had begun as an authentic sacrifice of one's own beloved sons and daughters, in hope of gaining the favor of the gods. But for a while now, wealthy Carthaginians had been running a macabre industry, a trade in other people's children for sacrifice. Plutarch paints a grisly portrait of these rituals. Those who had no children would buy little ones from poor people and cut their throats as if they were so many lambs or young birds. Meanwhile, the mother stood by without a tear or moan. But should she utter a single moan or let fall a single tear, she had to forfeit the money, and her child was sacrificed nevertheless, and the whole area before the statue was filled with a loud noise of flutes and drums, so that the cries of wailing should not reach the ears of the people. For a long time, it was believed that these stories were exaggerations, Greek propaganda designed to demonize their Carthaginian enemies. But modern archaeological discoveries have more or less confirmed that child sacrifice did take place, at least at some times, and at least by some people in the city. Large collections of buried urns containing the cremated remains of children have been found in temple sites known as tophets. Some of these temples are large, with collections of cremation urns exceeding 2,000 in number. Masks and symbols, incense burners and other paraphernalia suggest that the ceremonies were highly structured. We should not get carried away with these findings. At most of these sites, analysis has shown that the majority of the child remains are of stillborn babies, or babies who died of natural causes. The relative lack of children's remains in any of the regular graveyards seems to show that the Tophets were, at least in part, cremation sites for children who died naturally. But not all the remains seem to fit with normal patterns of child mortality, even in the ancient world. However the ritual had begun, at least in the later years of the city's existence, it clearly evolved into something darker and crueler. With the army of Agathocles drawing near, and their last citizen defenders defeated in the field, the Carthaginians believed their gods were angry with them, as Diodorus recounts. They also alleged that Cronus had turned against them, as in former times they had been accustomed to sacrifice to this god the noblest of their sons, but more recently secretly buying and nurturing children, they had sent these to the sacrifice. When they had given thought to these things and saw their enemy encamped before their walls, they were filled with superstitious dread, for they believed that they had neglected the honors of the gods that had been established by their fathers. In their zeal to make amends for their omission, they selected 200 of the noblest children and sacrificed them publicly. And others, who were under suspicion, sacrificed themselves voluntarily, in number not less than 300. Agathocles rampaged around the countryside of Carthage for years, even capturing the city of Hadrumetum. But Carthage itself kept him at bay, with its formidable triple-walled defences. The Greek king eventually ran out of steam and limped back home to Sicily. All the same, he had left a lasting impression on the people of Carthage, laid waste to the countryside, terrified them so deeply that they had slaughtered hundreds of their own children, and likely left them on the brink of bankruptcy. A peace treaty in 307 BCE essentially returned the situation in Sicily to how it had been before the war. The example of Agathocles, of a daring strike at the heart of your enemy right at the moment they least expect it, was one that later Carthaginian generals would remember. It was an episode that other powers in the region also paid particular attention to. Carthage had once been considered the region's major power, but a small Greek army had come within a hair's breadth of bringing it to its knees. Plutarch puts it bluntly in the mouth of one of his characters. "For who could keep his hands off Libya or Carthage when that city got within his reach? A city which Agathocles, slipping stealthily out of Syracuse and crossing the sea with a few ships, narrowly missed taking." The next to take advantage of this perceived weakness was another Greek king named Pyrrhus.